Hi there, I'm Mike Quinn. I played Ninum in the Star Wars films, and you're listening to Dylan Cardoni.
Special thanks to the wonderful Mr. Mike Quinn, who plays Ninum in the Star Wars franchise, who actually did that wonderful, fabulous, marvelous ID for me all the way back in October of 2019. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to hour number two of Vintage Cinema Music with Dylan Cardoni, right here on 101.5 The Hawk. As I do every single week, and I will most certainly say it again, this is the only Class of Movie show where I represent the Class of Movie soundtracks, the television, and some scores from the pre-code era of 1927's The Jazz Singer, all the way across to, of course, the new millennia of 2003. So, welcome again to our number two. What you just heard before that from the movie Norwood in 1970, that was Glen Campbell performing the opening theme to the movie. Coming up in just a couple minutes time, right around the corner, my interview with, of course, Academy Award winner and Golden Globe winner Dean Pitchford, where he talks about his life and career from the movies that he did, writing the screenplay to Footloose in 1984, as well as, of course, Sing in 89, and, of course, writing the music to the original 1980 film of fame, which is going on its 40th anniversary of this year. So let's begin with, of course, a couple of classic movie soundtracks in which Dean Pitchford had actually wrote for the movies in the 1980s. We'll get to Footloose in 1 minute time, but right now, let's take a look at the 1980 film version of Fame that was sung by Laura Dean, as well, of course, Irene Cara, Paul McCrane, as well as Tracy Parnell, and Eric Brookington singing the song entitled I Sing the Body Electric, right here on 101.5 The Hawk. You're listening to Vintage Cinema Music with Dylan Cardoni until we get to my interview with the wonderful Academy Award winner, Dean Pitchford.
I sing the
a wonderful Oscar-nominated song entitled Let's Hear It for the Boy from the 1984 musical film of Footloose that was sung in the movie by the wonderful Denise Williams. And right before that, celebrating its 40th anniversary of this year in 1980, that, of course, was Laura Dean, as well as Irene Cara, Paul McCrane, Tracy Parnell, and Eric Brookington performing the song I Sing the Body Electric from the movie musical of Fame. And speaking of both Fame and Footloose, did you ever wonder as to who did the music to these films? Well, I have a guest here who has pretty much did all of them. He, of course, is an Oscar-winning film and television songwriter. He has also won a Golden Globe and was nominated for 8 Grammy Awards, including 2 Tony Award nominations. He also did the screenplays to both Footloose back in 1984, as well as the movie Sing in the year of 1989, and has worked with many great filmmakers and artists such as Kenny Loggins to Michael Gore, Irene Cara, Kevin Bacon, and many, many others. It is a great pleasure to have the wonderful Mr. Dean Pitchford, who, in fact, I have on Zoom with me this afternoon right now. Good afternoon, Dean.
Good afternoon, Dylan. Hello from Santa Barbara, California.
How is everything going with you during this pandemic?
You know, it's actually, we have a place in Santa Barbara, so we got out of Los Angeles. We left our home there. And we are in an oak forest here where the sky is blue and the ocean breeze is cool. And the population density is 1/25th that of Los Angeles. And so all things considered, I cannot complain. And the air is great. And I'm not suffering through the heat that the rest of the United States is going through.
Dean, I know you have done great, but magnificent, fantastic work over the years. But I do want to ask, since I didn't really know about this at the time, but what I read, though, is that you were originally from Hawaii. Is that correct?
Yes. Born and raised in Honolulu. And then I went off, I left there, went off to college in New Haven. I went to Yale. And then the summer before my senior year, I figured that maybe I would get a little experience auditioning for shows in New York. And I was just going to dip my toe in the water. And I went into Manhattan and auditioned for a bunch of little shows, including a show that had just opened. It was off Broadway. It was non-union. And I got cast in Godspell.
What made you actually get into the world of both acting and singing at the time?
Well, when I was a kid growing up in Honolulu, my parents were both very musically interested. My father liked classical music. My mother liked Broadway music. But living in Honolulu, we didn't have access to a lot of that. And my father had a large collection of classical recordings that were all on 78 RPMs. My mother had a small collection of Broadway show albums, and I just listened to them until the labels fell off, because that was really all we had. But then I began performing. I began to sing, and I began to dance and work with local theater companies and cut my teeth with the Honolulu Symphony Orchestra, singing with them and a boys choir there. And then eventually got into work with what was at the time called the Honolulu Community Theater, HCT. It's now called Fort Ruger Theater, or Diamond Head Theater. It's now called Diamond Head Theater. But it's where I got my start. It's where Georgia Engel got her start. It's where Bette Midler got her start. And we all sort of came up performing at this little theater on the slopes of Diamond Head. And so I went off to college thinking that I wanted to go to Broadway and be a big Broadway actor, singer, dancer like I had seen on the Ed Sullivan Show. And so Godspell was my first foray into that area.
So a sidetrack from Godspell, as you just mentioned right now, let's talk about Bob Fosse for a little bit, because I know he is most certainly a true legend when it comes to both Broadway as well as the movie musicals throughout the 1970s. Do you remember the first time you met him when you were cast in the lead role in Pippin?
Yes. Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I was cast to stand by for the role of Pippin. And I was, at the time, working in Washington, D.C. doing Godspell. And my agent called and said, you know, your contract's coming up for an end, and they're looking for a standby for Pippin. Do you want to come up and audition for it? So I could only audition on Mondays. That was my day off from Godspell. So the audition was set for a Monday. I went up and I sang for the casting director. And I didn't know, I had no idea. There were a lot of other people singing. And I just went up, got back on the train, went back. And then my agent called and said, they want to see you again. They want to bring you back. And I said, well, I can come back next Monday. And so the next Monday, I go up. And in those days, you can't do this anymore because of union regulations governing what can happen in a theater. But in those days, you auditioned in the theater. You could audition in the theater where the show was performing. So you'd come in the stage door and then you'd walk out onto a stage, and everybody was seated in the dark auditorium. They didn't turn on the lights. And so I walked out on the stage. There was a pianist on the stage, played for me, and I sang. And then suddenly a voice said, hold on, Dean, just a second. And running down the aisle came Bob Fosse. And he ran up to the stage. He said, hi, Bob Fosse. He shook my hand like I needed an introduction. And I knelt down, and he gave me some direction. He gave me some ideas about what to do with the song. I was singing Corner of the Sky. And he sent me back up on stage, and I started again. And he said, great. He stopped me halfway through. Great. I've seen everything I need to see. And by the time I called in from Penn Station, where I was taking the train from, my agent had gotten the call, and I got cast. And so when I came back to New York after my contract in D.C. ended and I started rehearsals for Pippin, he came to a couple of my rehearsals, and then he came to my first performance and was very, very kind, came backstage, gave me wonderful, wonderful thoughts. And he said, you'll have my notes tomorrow. And the next day I walked into my dressing room, and in front of my dressing table was a typewritten list of his notes, which were very helpful and very to the point. And he had gone home, and I guess he dictated them or something, but they had been typed up and they were on my dressing table the next day. And it felt like it was so elegant. You know, it felt like old theater where the director sends you typewritten notes.
That's right.
And now I look back on it and I think, what did I do with those notes? If I knew that there was going to be such a thing as eBay one day, I would have saved Bob Fosse's notes to me.
What made you transition from acting into the world of movie music at the time?
Well, I wasn't aware I was going to transition into movie music. You know, I had started writing poetry in high school. And it was actually a collection of my poems that the guy who recruited me for Yale told me made the difference in my application. So it was the first time I'd ever gotten any validation for my writing in the world. I'd never shared my writing with anybody, not even my parents or my brothers. And so the first time I let some of my poetry out, I got accepted at Yale. And I thought maybe I should be thinking about writing as well as performing. So I wrote all the way through college, and then I got to New York and I got to know a woman who was a budding songwriter, and I showed her some of my poetry, and she said, you know, if this were tighter and more concise, you could be writing lyrics here. This is lyric writing. And so I realized that I not only, it was something that resonated with me because I had been studying Broadway cast recordings from the time I was 4 or 5 years old. And I knew what lyrics sounded like, and I knew how they looked on the page, and I knew how they fed into character. And I thought I was going to write, maybe I would be a Broadway writer, maybe I would be a writer like, at the time, Paul Simon was very popular, Billy Joel was very popular. And I began singing in clubs in New York, and I actually found a song by a young songwriter, which I sang in my act. And he came to see my show one night and asked whether I would consider writing with him. So if I was going to sing more of his material. And that's how I began writing with Alan Menken. And so Alan Menken and I both wanted to be the next Billy Joel. So we sort of had, although he ended up becoming king of Broadway, he also, in the beginning of his career, he had the Billy Joel bug. And I'm feeling the absence of a collaborator. And I started thinking, who else do I know that about that level, you know, who has a foot in the door at a record label, who might be willing to write with an unproven songwriter? And I remembered a singer-songwriter who did have a deal on A&M Records, and he and I had gotten to know each other because his voice lesson followed my voice lesson. And we came to the same teacher, and we would cross each other, and we would chat while we were coming in and going out. And then I began to follow his career when he would perform in cabarets around New York. And so I, on a whim, I folded up a bunch of my lyrics and I sent them off to Peter Allen. And Peter Allen called me and he said, I read your lyrics and they're really good. And he said, my manager wants me to stop performing in cabarets in New York, and he wants me to perform a one-man show on Broadway. And I'm coming into New York in about 3 weeks. Why don't we see whether we can write some new material for my Broadway show? And so all of a sudden, I had another semi-assignment. The phone rang, and it was a young composer who had seen the show the night before, had gone with his sister, the biggest-selling recording artist of the 60s, Leslie Gore, who is a friend of Peter's. She took her brother, Michael Gore, and Michael called and said, I saw your work in Peter's show. I am the music supervisor on a movie that's shooting in New York right now. Would you consider writing lyrics with me in the chance that we'll get our songs into this movie? So I wasn't hired by the movie. I was freelancing. And I met with Michael. We hit it off immediately. We discovered that we had been at Yale at the same time. We never met. When we were at Yale, we lived in New York City, four blocks from each other. We had never met in all the time I lived in New York. And we immediately fell into this. We were writing songs in the hope of getting them accepted for this or that slot. And several things happened in the course of that. When I started working with Michael on the movie, it was called Hot Lunch. That was the original title of Fame. And the director saw a marquee on 42nd Street, which was very sleazy during this period of the 70s. And there was a marquee at a porno house that advertised this movie, Hot Lunch. And he thought, I'm not going to call my movie Hot Lunch, but when there's a porn movie out there also called Hot Lunch. And so the decision was made like on a dime to change the title to Fame. And not many people knew that this was done. Michael Gore, who was always on the set, always at the shoot every day, wherever they were in Manhattan, came running home and called me and said, they've changed the name of the movie to Fame. We have a shot at writing a title song and maybe getting it accepted as the title of this movie. So we set about working on the song Fame. We had already written Red Light, and that was going to go in the movie. And I think we had written I Sing the Body Electric, but because nobody sings to the song Fame in the movie, it didn't need to be pre-recorded for playback. So it was being written in the last stages of the shooting of the picture and post-production. But anyway, I went from writing with Peter Allen just months before to suddenly having songs in a major motion picture that was shooting in New York City. How often does that happen?
Not ever.
And again, in the same way with, I got to know Bob Fosse before he became Bob Fosse. Mm-hmm. Alan Parker had done Midnight Express and he had done Bugsy Malone. And Fame was very early in his career. You know, he would go on to an astonishing career, which was I was reminded of last week when he passed away.
Yeah.
And his obituaries listed a lifetime of incredible work. But we were fortunate enough to work with him early on and got a glimpse of this incredible genius. Also, what made it a household name was the soundtrack album. Mm-hmm. The songs went up the charts. The album, I think, went several times platinum. It became a hit all over the world. And then Michael and I won the Academy Award. for that, and we were nominated for Grammys and Golden Globes. We won the Golden Globe for that, and so the soundtrack and the songs kind of set the pebble that was dropped in, began to ripple out and out and out and out, and the movie is remembered as a much bigger success than it was at the time. Not that it wasn't, it didn't do well. It just didn't do what I think MGM expected a movie musical was going to do. And you know, a part of it may have to do with the fact that it was a movie set in a high school with a lot of kids with either a PG or an R rating, because there was rough language, there was nudity. Yep. And so it sort of like missed its demographic. You had to be older and mature to go see a movie about high school kids. So that's, I think, what makes the movie hold up, is that it was dark.
It was
kind of unflinching in its look at what these kids put themselves through.
Did you ever actually have the chance to meet any of the cast members? Since I know you just mentioned that you never were actually on set, but Michael did. Did you ever actually meet them, like maybe at the red carpet or, you know, maybe somewhere off?
We did have to, you know, I Sing the Body Electric had to be written during the making of the motion picture and had to be pre-recorded. All those people sang to playback of their own vocals. So I was in the recording studio with Irene Cara and Laura Dean and Paul McCrane and everybody else who was in that number, the choir, you know, the gospel choir and the chorus of the kids in the school. And not only did the recording of that song span several days, but then the filming of that number spanned a week. That was 5 days of morning to night shooting in the high school auditorium in the course of that number.
Let's talk about the Oscars for a minute. I mean, were you stunned or surprised when Angie Dickinson had announced your names? And what was the experience like? Because I know when I interviewed Michael Dana back in March of 2020 of this year, he told me that he was not expecting that at all. Was it the same with you as well?
It was not at all. I mean, we first of all, Fame had opened in the spring of the year before. And so you become aware when you go through awards season, you become aware of how long or short the voters' memories are. And so I thought that it was a problem that we had been out for as long as we had, especially because the big hit of the Christmas season, just prior to Oscar season, the big hit of that season was 9 to 5. So they were all over the airwaves and they were all over TV, and Dolly Parton is so lovable and wonderful. And we sort of worried that we might get forgotten in the, you know, and then in those days, the Oscars were done at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. And at the Dorothy Chandler, there's no center aisle. There are just rows all the way across. And so we arrived to our seats and discovered that we were well in the row. And at the end of our row was Dolly Parton on the aisle. And so we went, well, there you have it. I mean, if we needed any further sign, it's Dolly is positioned so that she can jump right up and go up and get her statuette. And then they called our names. And Michael and I got up and we did, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me. And we went past everybody. And Dolly had gotten up out of her chair and she threw her arms wide at the end of the aisle. She says, "You're not getting past me. You're not getting past me," in a very good hearted way. And then she hugged us both and she sent us on our way. It was a wonderful moment. And I was completely out of my body.
Dean, I wanted to talk about Footloose for a few minutes because, I mean, let's face it, it is one of the greatest movie musicals of all time, you know, during the years of the 1940s. I do want to ask is, how did you come up with the story of Footloose and what made you get into like screenwriting?
Well, several things, actually. One was a very dear friend of mine who I had known when he worked in theater in New York was by that point living in Los Angeles. His name was Craig Zaden. And if you Google him, you'll find his name on many Academy Award nominated and winning movies, including Chicago and Hairspray. And he produced the original Footloose. But before that, I had come out to Los Angeles. He was living in LA. I began living in Los Angeles. And I was getting songs placed in various motion pictures. And it was Craig, who was working at a film studio, who said, you know what you ought to do? Why don't you write a movie and then put your own songs in it rather than waiting for somebody to come and ask for a song here or a song there? So I thought, well, that's an interesting prospect. And my agent at the time said, let's see whether we can get you set up with a movie someplace. So I went running around town meeting with all these executives at various studios, and they all had an idea for a movie. And the movie was basically this. It was about a boy or a girl who wanted to be a pop singer, a Broadway singer, or a country singer. And they went to Nashville or New York or Los Angeles, and they played in clubs and they recorded in studios. And there's your soundtrack album right there, all that stuff that's recorded. And I would listen to these pitches from them, and having come from Broadway theater, where people sing in the most unlikely of circumstances. They don't need to be in a club in front of a microphone stand or in a recording studio to sing. And I found all of these ideas rather boring. And I kept thinking, I would like to find an idea where music is unexpected. Music comes like out of the blue and you go, whoa, what just happened? And so about that time when I was formulating this idea and not knowing what that looked like, I saw a little item in a newspaper. Actually, it was the San Francisco Chronicle. I was up there one weekend and I saw a little item in the paper that said that a town in Oklahoma called Elmore City, Oklahoma, had repealed an 88-year ordinance forbidding public dancing in the town of Elmore City. And that year, the high school senior class had its first prom in 88 years. And I thought, well, there's some place where you might not expect to hear music or see dancing, a town where you cannot dance. And so I began by writing a couple of drafts of a kind of threw together some ideas for a town like this, and then realized that I'd better get on the ground and do some research. So a producer in Los Angeles named Dan Melnick paid to fly me to Oklahoma, and I went to Elmore City, and I couldn't stay there because there was no motel. It's that small. I stayed down the road in Ardmore. But then I went to Elmore City every day for almost a week, and I went to the high school, and I went to prayer meetings, and I went to stores along Main Street, and I interviewed kids, and I went home with them to meet their families, and I soaked up the atmosphere of Elmore City, and I went back to Los Angeles, and I wrote Footloose.
How fun was it to write the lyrics for Footloose with Kenny Loggins as your collaborator? I mean, he is, well, certainly, the king of the movie soundtrack.
It was great to work with Kenny on this. We had been introduced prior to the movie and had kind of thrown together saying, see whether you guys can come up with something. And he sent me a melody, a cassette tape with a melody on which he and another singer were laying out a cadence and the rough of a melody to a song. And I set the lyric not knowing that who the other voice on the tape was. But when Kenny got my lyric, he said, this is terrific. I think we're gonna record this as a duet, me and Steve. And I said, Steve? He said, yeah, Steve Perry, the lead singer of Journey. And I didn't realize that I had written a duet for Kenny Loggins and Steve Perry. So not only did it come out and became a big radio hit, it got them both a Grammy nomination for Best Rock Vocal Duo. And so going into the writing of Fame, Kenny and I were collaborating. We were already comfortable with each other. And, that song was written over a very long period of time because we started the writing of it before Kenny went on an Asian tour. He left and came back 6 weeks later, and we finished it at his house in the middle of the night on the same night that the last episode of MASH was broadcast. And I arrived to write with him, and he said, we got to sit down and watch this. So we watched MASH, and then his kids needed to be fed and put to bed. We put the kids to bed, and one thing led to another, and we ended up finishing the song. We couldn't make any noise in the main part of the house, so we ended up in the laundry room, and he sat up on the washing machine, and I sat on the floor, and we finished writing Fame while an enormous rainstorm raged outside. We finished writing Footloose in Kenny Loggins' laundry room.
What was it like working with Kevin Bacon for the film? I mean, I don't know if anybody would think that he would actually do a movie musical production such as this, or actually any movie musical production, to be exact.
Well, here's the thing. You know, it was very early on in Kevin's career, and I think he had done Animal House, he had done Friday the 13th, but he was killed very early in Friday the 13th, and he had a small role in Animal House.
And he was also in Diner as well, right?
So. It was in Diner. Oh, yeah. What a performance. Here's the thing. You know, Kevin was, under the skin, a stage performer. He was living in New York. He was working in New York. So the first round of casting that we did in Los Angeles, we didn't see him. It wasn't until we put on a casting director to beat the bushes in Manhattan that he came across our sights. And he was in New York. He was doing an off-Broadway show at the time called Slab Boys. And that was where we found him. And so I think it was a combination of, he was intrigued by the challenge of the role, but he was also seduced by Herbert Ross, was one of the most formidable directors in Hollywood. Here he is doing an off-Broadway show for next to no money. Herbert Ross flies in to screen test him and says all the right things, and Kevin says all the right things. And I don't think that there was any question that Kevin was going to do the role for Herbert.
What made you get involved in contributing music for Shrek 2? Because I know that the song I Need a Hero was pretty much like a redone version of Footloose, or... did the producers at DreamWorks want to see if they can get permission from you to use the song for the movie?
Well, it's not. The thing is that because I wrote that for a studio, the studio and the publishing company of that studio, which is Sony Music, they control the rights. Holding Out for a Hero had become a kind of anthem. It had built up and built up over the years. And it's more popular now than it was when the movie of Footloose came out. And they, in the movie of Shrek, if you take a look at the movie of Shrek, Shrek 1 and Shrek 2, they used a lot of existing covers. They re-recorded existing songs, you know, like I'm a Believer by the Monkees. And they basically plundered the popular songbook. But with Holding Out for a Hero, they needed it to do book work as well. It needed to cover a long sequence at the end of the movie where Fiona is going to be married off to the wrong guy, and Shrek is trying to save her, and the wicked stepmother, the fairy stepmother, is singing the song on a stage in a send-up. So if you look at it, it's a very, very long sequence. And they cut the song all around dialogue and action. And to be honest, I did not know, nor did Sony know, how far down the road they had gone. But when the deal was finally made, I got very, very excited because I was anxious to see my song sung, our song, Jim Steinman, and my song sung by animated characters that we had not intended it to. And then as it turned out, it was sung in the movie by the actress playing the fairy godmother. Yeah. All very cool. All I had nothing to do with. I just showed up and watched the movie and went, wow. We are the last 7 minutes of this movie.
What about the Lizzie McGuire movie? I mean, that song, you know, What Dreams Are Made Of, was like sort of like, you know, upbeat. And, you know, it was very, you know, popular for kids and young teenagers, particularly when the movie came out. How did you get involved with that, as well as working with Disney at that time period?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. It's a little bit involved in that at one point, Disney had they had their Sunday evening block where The Wonderful World of Disney would go on. And they began to do musicals in that block. And my friend Craig Zaden produced Cinderella with Whitney Houston and Brandy in that. Mm-hmm. He did a version of Annie with Kathy Bates and Kristen Chenoweth. And so they came to Disney with the idea, what if we do a television Footloose for the Wonderful World of Disney? And that idea lasted about 3 months, during which I met the director who was going to be doing it, a man named Jim Fall. And Jim Fall and I had the best time doing the rewrite on the television version. And then finally, Paramount went, what are we, crazy? That's an intellectual property that we control. Why are we letting Disney have it? No, we'll hold it back and maybe we'll remake it ourselves. So the carpet got yanked out from underneath us, but Jim and I stayed good friends. And then Jim, all of a sudden, out of the blue, was the replacement director. There was some problem on the Lizzie McGuire movie with the director, and they got rid of one, called Jim, and the next day he was on a plane to Rome. And he was calling me from Rome, and he was saying, you know, after we're finished here, we're going to go back to Vancouver and finish the movie. And I'm very nervous because the entire movie culminates at the Coliseum in a full outdoor concert with Lizzie singing a duet with her double. She sings with herself through the magic of cinematography. And he said, can you help me? Can you write something for me? So I got together with my friend Matthew Wilder, the music in Mulan, and we wrote What Dreams Are Made Of. And we set it off. By that time, they were back in Vancouver. Everybody loved the song. They said, this is terrific. We'll be recording this, we're kicking it to the end because it's so involved. It means rehearsing dancers. It means building the sets. It means green screen, all the doubling and all that stuff. Then they did the pre-record, and then I got a panic phone call from Jim, and he said, I'm working with, he had selected the choreographer that he was working with, but he said, the person that they've given me to work with doesn't know about camera blocking, doesn't know, she can choreograph for the stage, but she doesn't know how to break down a song into camera blocking. Can you come? Can you help? And I said, when do you need me? He said, can you be here tonight? And I threw stuff into a bag. A car pulled up in front of my house about 45 minutes later. I went to LAX and I was flown to Vancouver. And the next morning I began in a rehearsal studio with breaking the song down, the dancers, figuring on the camera angles, how many cameras would be covering, not only on stage, but the audience. And so I think I was there for 4 days setting it all up, but I wasn't there for any of the filming. I just left him a shot list, you know, page after page after page of a shot list. And he was off shooting other pieces of the movie during the day and would come into the rehearsal and I'd show him what we'd done and how we had prepared it.
Dean, thank you so much for taking the time for doing this today. It was a great pleasure and honor talking to you today.
It was a joy. I enjoyed our trip down memory lane. Thanks so much, Dylan.
Minor, put it in C minor.
Where have all the good men gone, and where are all the gods? Where's the streetwise Hercules to fight the rising odds? Isn't there a white knight upon a fiery steed? Late at night I toss and I turn and I dream of what I need.
I need a hero. I'm holding out for a hero till the end of the night. He's gotta be strong and he's gotta be fast and he's gotta be fresh from the fight. Till the morning light.
seems such a beautiful night. I could almost kiss the stars for shining so bright.
From the year of 2003, that of course was Hilary Duff singing from the Lizzie McGuire movie entitled What Dreams Are Made Of. And right before that, from the year of 2004, that of course was a remake version of Holding Out for a Hero that was sung by Jennifer Saunders for the movie of Shrek 2. And right before that, from the year of 1984, that of course was Kenny Loggins singing the Oscar-nominated song entitled Footloose. That was, all of those were actually written and composed by the wonderful Mr. Dean Pitchford. Special thanks to him who actually did that wonderful interview with me. Thank you once again, Dean. Next week on Vintage Cinema Music with Dylan Cardone, another box office chart of the week in hour number one and in hour number two, class movie soundtracks and maybe some television that involve around the key of animals. Remember, that's coming up next week on Vintage Cinema Music with Dylan Cardone between 12 to 2 o'clock p.m. Let's end our show with, of course, the movie of fame that was sung by Irene Cara right here on 101.5 The Hawk. Until next week, as we say in the movies, that's a wrap. Take care and enjoy the rest of your weekend. Have yourself a fabulous day, and I will see you at the movies.